for incriminating evidence of my drunkenness, but I didn't send a single message after work. There is, however, something else worrying on my home screen. A new icon. A dating app. I have no recollection of downloading it. I don't really remember anything after the bar. I clamber out of bed and wait for the pounding in my skull to subside before staggering out into the living room. I feel like I'm made of nuclear waste. The apartment is quiet, but not clean. A half-dozen half-drunk water glasses litter the coffee table, the counter, and the two-person breakfast table. The bottle of coconut rum is empty, and both wine bottles are down to dregs. I feel like Hercule Poirot stumbling on a murder mystery without any body or even blood, just the bothersome suspicion that something happened here. Something important. And then my phone starts ringing in my hand. I see his name on screen. All at once, I remember. And I really, really wish I didn't. 5. Sunday, May 19th. 90 days until I can leave. I try to gather myself, to catch my breath and clear my throat so I won't have to answer in a dehydrated croak. Of course, I don't have to answer. But this is the first time I've heard from Peter in weeks, and the thought of not hearing what he has to say, of simply wondering forever, makes me feel sick. Just kidding. Gil's shots are doing that just fine. The name Gil just occurred to me out of thin air, the image of his braided gray beard flashing across my mind. I clamp my phone against my ear and beeline toward the window for fresh air. It's cool out, more spring than summer today. "Hello," I say, too loud, too forceful, and too cheery, a rare trifecta.
"Daphne?"
Peter's soft voice fills my head like helium. "Yes," I say. There's a pause.
"You sound different."
"I feel different," I reply. No idea why that's what comes out.
"Oh."
There's a silence on the other end. "So," I say. Another pause.
"So, I got your RSVP.
I dig the heel of my hand into my forehead and press hard against the throbbing there. "Yeah."
"And I guess I just..."
He takes a breath.
"I wanted to make sure everything was okay."
"Okay?" I feel like I'm back in high school calculus, random bits of equations and numbers drifting around me nonsensically. There's some kind of meaning there, but I do not have the right brain to interpret it.
"Yeah, I mean..."
A soft breath.
"You don't have to come, you know."
My laugh sounds more like a cough.
"I mean, of course we'd love to have you," he hurries on.
The sound of "we" alone is enough to make the contents of my stomach flip around like I chugged clam chowder, then hopped on a roller coaster. "We" used to be the "we" he talked about.
"I just wanted to make sure you knew there was no pressure on our end," he says.
"Our. We. Let's get all the most painful words out on the table and make sure each one positively drips with condescension. The worst part is, even after all this, I'm not positive I don't love him. I mean, not this version of him, but the part that remembered every important date, who brought home flowers just because he happened to be walking past a cart selling them, the Peter who had my favorite soup delivered to me every time I got sick. The parts reserved for her now.
"We know how hard this must be for you,"
he's saying, and just like that, he snaps back into the other Peter, the one I hate.
"And I hate to think of you there, on your own."
As if this whole thing isn't humiliating enough, he's called me to make sure I know he feels bad for me. I'm seeing red. "I won't be alone," I say.
"I mean, without a date," he clarifies, completely unnecessarily.
"I know," I say. "I'm bringing my boyfriend." Even as I'm saying it, there's a voice screeching in my brain, "What are you doing?" I face the window and pantomime a scream, one hand dragging down the side of my face. I wonder if this exact scenario inspired Edvard Munch's The Scream.
"Your boyfriend?"
Peter's voice emanates sheer disbelief.
"No," my brain says.
"Yes,"
my mouth says. "But you didn't RSVP for a plus one."
I'm not usually a liar. In fact, I still sometimes lie awake thinking about a time in the sixth grade when I'd just switched schools and a girl struck up a conversation with me about my horse necklace, and in my desperation to make friends, some foul demon possessed me to tell the girl I loved horses and grew up going to horse riding camp every summer. I'd been horseback riding twice. I fell off the second time, if that matters. After that conversation, I'd avoided that girl out of guilt. Lucky for me, we moved again 6 months later. But apparently, the demon has finally tracked me down again, because without thinking, without planning, a lie emerges from my mouth, fully formed. "I didn't need a plus one. He got his own invitation." The weighty silence tells me Peter is doing invisible calculus now. Only he's got the brain for it.
"You can't mean..."
His voice slides past disbelief, straight into incredulity.
"You're with Miles?"
"No, no, no," the voice in my head screams. "Yep," my mouth chirps. I am instantly back to silent Munch screaming out the window. The next silence extends too long. I'm incapable of breaking it because the only thing I can think to say is, "I don't know why I said that. It's an outright lie." But I also cannot tell him that. Peter clears his throat.
"Well, the wedding's not for a few months."
"I know," I say. "Labor Day."
"A lot could change before then," he says.
My jaw drops. Is he really insinuating that my fake relationship won't survive 3 months to his wedding when his relationship started just over a month ago? "We'll be there," I say. "No," my brain screams.
"Okay," Peter says.
I need to get off the phone before I involuntarily spring a fictional pregnancy on him. "I've got to go, Peter. Take care."
"Yeah," he says. "You too."
I hang up. I pace in front of the window for about 5 seconds, then go straight to Miles's door, a sinner on her way to confession. I knock. No answer. I pound. "Miles, are you up?" I rattle the knob, or I expect to, but it's unlocked. So instead, I basically just fall into his room, catching myself against his dresser. The TV atop it wobbles, and as I steady it, a voice says from behind me,
"Are you stealing my TV?"
I turn, expecting to find Miles sprawled out in his bed. Instead, he's standing in the doorway, fully dressed with a grease-mottled paper bag in hand. I release the TV. "I almost knocked it over," I explain.
"Why?"
he asks. "I told Peter we were dating," I say. He stares at me for 3 seconds, then laughs.
"What does that have to do with the TV?"
"Nothing," I say. He laughs again and turns back to the hallway. "Where are you going?" I call.
"To get sriracha," he says.
"Why?" I say, trailing him to the kitchen.
"For my breakfast sandwich."
He drops the bag on the counter on his way to the fridge.
"Did you hear what I said?" I ask.
"You told Peter we were dating,"
he confirms, rifling around the fridge for the hot sauce.
"Aren't you mad?"
I say. He spins back with the sriracha bottle and an unmarked jar of something dark and goopy.
"Why would I be mad?"
"Because we aren't dating," I say.
"I'm aware."
He dumps the bag out onto the counter, and two yellow paper-wrapped sandwiches fall out. He slides one toward me, then turns to the already full coffee pot. "How long have you been up?"
"I don't know,"
he shrugs.
"Hour or two."
He carries two steaming mugs back to the counter. He gives me a mug with Garfield the cat wearing a cowboy hat on it.
"Cream? Sugar?"
I shake my head. I'm not much of a coffee drinker. I'll just sip enough to take the edge off of this hangover. Miles opens the jar and spoons a little, probably maple syrup, into his coffee.
Is that good? I ask, leaning forward to watch.
I don't know, he says. Seems like it would be, though. Did you drunk dial?
What? I say.
Did you call Peter drunk?
He says, unwrapping his sandwich, flipping it open, and absolutely slathering the egg and avocado inside with sriracha.
No, he called me.
He pauses with the sandwich halfway to his mouth. He lets out another laugh and lowers the sandwich.
Wait, did we RSVP to their wedding last night?
Hearing it said aloud, again, sends a full-body shudder through me. Groaning, I drop my face against my forearms on the counter.
Wait.
Miles presses his palm into my forehead and tips my face up so he can meet my eyes.
That's why he called? Because he got the RSVP?
I nod. He called to tell me I don't have to come. That he knows how hard it will be for me to be there, all by my lonesome, so utterly shattered and alone and lonely and unloved. Miles snorts.
Smug little prick.
He's 6'4", I say.
Smug giant douche,
he amends. Then, after a minute.
Or, I don't know, maybe he genuinely thought he was being nice?
No, you were right the first time.
Miles unwraps my breakfast sandwich partway and shoves it toward my face. I take a bite, and then he sets it down in front of my chin.
Wait!
He braces his hands against the counter, face brightening.
So he called to try to make you feel so pathetic you wouldn't come ruin his special day, and you told him we were dating?
I'm sorry, I say again.
That fucking rules,
he says.
How'd he take it?
Some silence, some scoffs of disbelief, I say. A gentle reminder that the wedding's not for 3 months and there's no way you and I will still be dating by then. Pretty perceptive of him, given that we're not dating now.
I drop my face, groaning anew at the fresh round of hammering inside my brain.
Eat something, Miles says. It will help.
I pitch myself onto one of the mismatched wooden stools at the counter and slide the sandwich toward me, taking a forceful bite.
Maybe we should date,
Miles says. I choke. He watches me coughing, an impish grin forming on his impish mouth.
Yes, I finally manage. A shared cuckolding is the most fertile ground from which love could ever spring.
Yeah, that, he says. And it would piss them off.
As you pointed out, I say, they don't care. They're getting married, Miles.
And 6 weeks ago, you were getting married, he says.
Hey, if you're willing to keep reminding me of that daily, I can go ahead and rename my morning alarm something other than, wake up, you've been jilted, bitch.
No, I mean, a few weeks ago, you and Peter were engaged, and yet he was jealous of me, and you were jealous of Petra.
Excuse you, I say.
I'm quoting you,
he says. From when? I say.
Halfway through the third time you put on Witchy Woman last night?
I narrow my gaze.
You don't remember anything that happened, do you?
He seems tickled at the thought.
I remember Glenn, I say.
Gil, he says.
Right.
My point is, just because they're engaged, it doesn't mean they're above jealousy.
He takes another sip of coffee. I reach feebly toward the maple syrup jar, and he nudges it closer to me. I spoon some into my mug and take a sip.
What do you think?
He asks, leaning forward. Pretty good, I say. Where'd it come from?
Oh, just one of my countless odd jobs,
he says. My cheeks heat. He laughs into another huge bite of his sandwich, which reminds me to eat mine.
We're not going to their wedding as a fake couple, I say.
He shrugs.
Okay.
You're not going to convince me.
Fine,
he says.
I'm serious, I say.
Does he still follow you on social media or did you block him?
He asks. I squirm on the stool and busy myself with another sip.
I unfollowed him, but I didn't block him.
Some very pathetic part of me didn't want to close the door entirely. I wanted him to miss me, even a tiny fraction of the amount I missed him. I wanted him to regret losing me.
I have not made a single post since we broke up. I go on. I don't know if he still follows me or not.
Yes, you do, Miles says.
Okay, fine. As of yesterday, he did.
Can I see your phone?
Miles asks. I don't want to block him, I say.
I'm not going to, he promises.
I hand my phone over, and he sets down his sandwich, chewing as he taps around on the screen. Then he rounds the counter to stand behind me, holding the phone out in front of us, the selfie camera on. He hunches over, hooking his free arm around my collarbones and flashing a dimpled grin. What are you doing? I ask, turning toward him, my nose grazing his cheekbone.
Got it,
he says, straightening up and pushing my phone back into my hand. The picture he took is still on screen. I'm mid-word, my lips practically on his face, and he's smiling, a slew of his disjointed, sailor-style forearm tattoos draped across my chest in an easy, yet vaguely suggestive way. We look very much like a couple, if you ignore the fact that we also look like two people who'd have exactly nothing in common. Then again, I guess that's how straight-laced Peter and free-spirited Petra look side by side. It's just that Petra wears the aesthetic like an edgy pop starlet, and Miles looks kind of like the guy from high school who intentionally failed his senior year to stick around for a while, then started selling bootleg cologne out of the trunk of his car in the mall parking lot. Not that I look much better. There's a smear of avocado on my chin. What am I supposed to do with this? I say.
Whatever you want.
Miles crumples the paper sandwich sheath and tosses it into the trash. Meaning?
Daphne.
He slumps forward on his elbows, raking a hand up through his hair. It stays put, defying gravity. His beard is likewise sticking out in dark tufts like he's a bedraggled and hungover young Wolverine.
You know what I'm getting at.
You want me to post this so he'll think we're dating, I say.
No, he says, bemused. I personally want you to post it so Petra thinks we're dating.
Why can't you post it? I say.
Because I don't have any social media, he says.
Right. I remember Peter telling me this. I'd been scrolling through Petra's, frankly, professional-grade influencer feed, and not only was Miles not tagged in any pictures, but his face wasn't even in any. When I asked Peter about it, he rolled his eyes and said something cranky about Miles being too good for social media. Just the thought of it now is enough to tip me over the edge. I don't write a caption. I just post the picture. Miles grins and high-fives me.
Are we evil or just immature?
He says. I think maybe just bitter, I reply. Hey, thanks for the breakfast sandwich, by the way.
Thanks for the pep talk last night,
he says. When did that happen? I ask.
Halfway through the fourth time we played Witchy Woman, he says.
A fuzzy memory surfaces just for a second before submerging into the wine and liquor haze again, standing on a sticky floor in the glow of a neon sign holding on to either side of Miles's face as I enunciated as clearly as I could manage, "It's going to get easier. This time next year, you won't even remember her name."
If we keep drinking like this, he replied, I'm not sure I'll even remember my name.
Miles grabs the sriracha and twists the lid back onto the syrup jar.
I've got stuff to do, but if you hear from your ex, tell him I said.
He holds up his middle finger. If you hear from yours, tell her thanks for the new boyfriend.
Gladly,
he says, and turns to go. 6. Friday, May 24th. 85 days until I can leave. The following Friday, I'm playing my least favorite kind of Tetris at the reference desk, choosing which fall releases to buy for our branch, rearranging and reprioritizing them, cutting title after title until the moment the cost dips into our budget. Every time I go to remove a book, a different face flashes in my mind, the kid or kids I specifically picked the book for.
a superhero picture book for Aram, an early reader about mermaids for 8-year-old Gabby Esteves, a dense upper YA fantasy that reminded me of the first time I read Philip Pullman for Maya, the braces-wearing preteen with a Smith's patch on her backpack, and a reading level so far above her age that she started giving me recommendations. She's shy enough that it took months to get her to really respond to my attempts at book-related small talk, the only kind I can do, but now she'll happily chat for 40 minutes at a time about books we've both read and loved, an informal 2-person book club. I've been working on convincing her to join one of the teen readers groups, but she's very politely informed me that she doesn't like group activities and is more of an independent type. Basically, she's me at 12 years old, if I'd been 900 times cooler, right down to the fact of being the only child of an overworked but lovely single mother with a penchant for 80s British goth rock. During the school year, Maya walks the short distance from the junior high to the library, and her mom picks her up when she finishes her paralegal shift. The new hardcover fantasy I handpicked for her is the most expensive book on the list, but I can't bear to cut it. Ordinarily, I talk this kind of thing over with Harvey, the branch manager, but he left early for his youngest daughter's med school graduation. The other two are already doctors. He's apparently created an army of high achievers. Back in the office we all share, the adult librarian, Ashley Rahimi, is on the phone, the shut door reducing her words to a flat rumble. On the desk, my own phone buzzes with a notification from Sadie. My gut rises expectantly, only to plummet when I see that instead of a message or even a comment, she simply liked my most recent picture. The one in which I appear to be milliseconds away from licking the side of Miles's face as he hangs over me, arm latched across my chest. I tap over to Sadie's account and instantly regret it. She uses social media as infrequently as I do, which means there, right in the top row of images, 3 shots back, is a picture of her and Cooper with me and Peter at Chill Coast Brewing on their last visit, beer being the one thing Peter breaks his low-carb diet for. I personally hate beer. Obviously, Petra loves it. She's a walking fantasy, and I'm a librarian who actually does wear a lot of buttons and tweed. From behind the office door comes a frustrated shriek groan, not an outright scream, but a sound loud enough to cause kids gaming at the computer bay to spin toward the desk in unison.
"It's fine. Everything's fine," I tell them with a wave.
Behind me, the door flings open, and Ashley, 5-foot-nothing with a topknot the size of a melon, storms out.
"Never make friends with moms," she tells me before stomping over to her rolling chair.
"You're a mom," I point out.
She whips toward me. "I know," she cries, "and that means I have basically one night every 2 weeks when I can do something fun with other adults, except all those other adults I used to call are also parents, and in many cases, partners. So half the time, the plans fall through because someone's puking or fell off a trampoline or forgot they have to build a fucking volcano for science class by tomorrow."
"Ashley," I hiss, jerking my head toward the row of teenage gamers. She follows my gaze and greets their stares with a blunt,
"What?"
They spin back toward their screens.
"I want to get out," she says. "I want to look hot in public and drink alcohol and talk about something other than Dungeons and Dragons."
And as she's saying it, I'm picturing myself at home, alone, watching happy couples shop for or renovate the homes of their dreams on HGTV, just like I did last Friday night, and the Friday night before that, and basically every night since the breakup, barring my drunken meat locker escapade with Miles. Meanwhile, Peter's and Petra's social media feeds are an in-real-time documentation of her and Peter kissing, hugging, and selfieing their way through our old haunts with our old friends in Arbor Park. His haunts, I correct myself. His friends, just like Arbor Park is his neighborhood. I'd thought we were building something permanent together,
Now I realize I'd just been slotting myself into his life, leaving me without my own. I feel the words rushing up my throat, and then they're splatting out between us. I'm free tonight. Ashley stares, wide-eyed, like I just threw up on her shoes, or like I threw up a whole shoe. I search for a graceful way to take it back. I've landed on something along the lines of, oh, shoot, I forgot. I have plans to organize my e-reader. When she gives an abrupt shrug and says, why not? Text me your address and I'll pick you up on the way to Chillcoast. Chillcoast? I'm sure my face just went from tomato red to milky white. Luckily, Ashley is looking at her phone. It's a brewery, she says, typing. In Arbor Park? My friend who just bailed said it's super cute, has a big patio. There is absolutely no way I can go to Chillcoast. Waning Bay is small enough without me wandering directly into the heart of the Peterverse. Unless, Ashley reads my hesitancy, you had somewhere else in mind? Of course I don't have somewhere else in mind. I don't foresee Ashley loving Meat Locker. But I have to say something, so I blurt the first place, the only place, that springs to mind. Cherry Hill. Her dark brow lifts appraisingly. It's a winery. Is that the one with the hot drug dealer bartender, or the one down the road from that one, where they only play Tom Petty? I say, I really only know about the wine. In that I know they have wine. After a protracted pause, she says, okay, Cherry Hill. Great, I say. She goes back to scanning books in. Are you going to dress like that? I look down at my brown, high-necked button-up. No? A coworker and I are going to stop by Cherry Hill tonight, I tell Miles from the doorway as he's brushing his teeth in our tiny, pink-tiled bathroom. He meets my eyes in the mirror, toothpaste foam spilling out of his mouth.
Why did you say it like that? He asks.
Like what?
Menacingly.
He spits into the sink and knocks the faucet on.
Like, me and my friend are gonna pay you a little visit and we might have a baseball bat with us.
Because me and my friend are going to pay you a visit, I say, and we might have a baseball bat with us. He thrusts his head into the sink, under the running water to rinse. When he straightens up, he grabs his towel from the rack and buries his whole face in it. I just thought it might be weird for me to show up without mentioning it, I say. He faces me, one hand and hip propped against the sink.
I'm flattered you remember where I work.
I needed somewhere cool to impress Ashley, and it leapt out of my subconscious, I admit.
Was she impressed?
He asks.
Does she like our wine?
No idea, I say. But she thinks one of your bartenders is a drug dealer, or plays a lot of Tom Petty. He frowns.
She must not have tried the Pinot.
I laugh in surprise. Are you offended?
A little, he admits, shrugging. It's a double gold winner. Make sure she tries it tonight.
I'll do my best, I say. For a second, we just stand there. He waves toward the doorway, which I'm blocking. Right. I step aside, and he breezes past, his warm, vaguely spicy scent hitting me.
I'll see you later,
I call over my shoulder, shutting myself in my room to continue my, so far unproductive, outfit selection. Wool, tweed, satin posing as silk— every piece of it easily matched to every other piece, and all of it a bit stodgy professor, even my casual summer clothes. Sadie used to say my look sat at the intersection of personal style as a statement about personality and don't look at my body, which is essentially accurate. A quick Google search of what to wear to a winery reveals a plethora of the kind of bright and airy clothes that could be plucked from an Ellen Hildebrand novel. My own wardrobe is mostly creams, tans, camels, browns. I could just go with a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, but I suspect that between showing up overdressed and underdressed, the latter would be the greater sin to Ashley, and I want to make a good impression.
So, I swallow my pride.
and put on the slinky, backless black dress I bought for Peter's and my engagement party. I haven't worn it since, which is stupid because it cost way more than I would ordinarily spend. Peter bought it, and it's extremely flattering. 7:15, someone knocks on the door. I'm not surprised she's late. I am surprised she came to the door. I thought I'd have 3 flights of stairs to get over my hanging out with someone new nerves before I was face to face with her. It's been years since I made a new friend. I mean, actually made a new friend, not just inherited one from Peter or from Sadie, who's always been more of a social butterfly than me. I smoothed the front of my dress, a nervous 16-year-old about to find out whether she really scored a date to the prom or if the other kids are about to dump pig's blood on her. When I open the door, Ashley jumps a little because she'd been looking at her phone. "You didn't have to come up," I say. "You could have texted me from the car." "I drank a Pedialyte on the way over here and my bladder's bursting," she says. "Plus, I know basically nothing about you, so this was a good chance to find out if your house is full of surveillance equipment." I blink. "Surveillance equipment?" "Landon and I have been taking bets on whether you're in the FBI," she provides helpfully. I squint at her. "And you think I'm in the FBI because..." "I don't," she says. "Landon does. My guess is witness protection." There's being bad at small talk, and then there's being so reticent that your coworkers assume you've recently testified against a mob boss, and I never knew how thin the line between the two was. In my defense, Landon is 19 years old and nearly always listening to shoegaze in his AirPods at the decibel of a launching rocket, so it's not like there have been loads of opportunities to bond. "Bathroom's this way," I say, leading her inside. She gawks as she follows, apparently unbothered by the lack of surveillance equipment. We pause in front of the entrance to the hallway, where Miles's room, the bathroom, and my room are tucked off of the living room. "Cute place," she says. "Thanks," I say, though honestly, this is all pretty much Miles, a funky mix of thrift store pieces from the 50s to 70s, Laurel Canyon chic. She shuts herself in the bathroom, quite possibly, I think, to dig through my medicine cabinet, and I go back to the kitchen for another glass of water. In college, I really took the posters that littered our dorm rooms to heart. 1-to-1, if at all, they read, with an illustrated beer bottle beside an illustrated glass of water. The habit stuck. From the kitchen, I hear the bathroom door whine open, and I pad back into the living room, but Ashley isn't there.
"Do you snowboard?"
she calls from around the corner, down the hallway.
"What?"
I pass through the doorway and see her not on the right in my room, but to the left in Miles's. She's wandering through it like it's a museum, moving from the snowboard and battered hockey sticks in the corner to the plants and incense holders in the windowsill.
"This is my roommate's room," I tell her.
She's reading the tiny text around the edge of a framed show poster, but I'm fixated on the framed photograph of Miles and Petra on his dresser. They stand in front of the lake, her arms slung around his waist, a less scruffy version of him looking down at her adoringly. She's waifish and cute, and he's rangy and winsome, and it's impossible to hate this version of her, the one who made him so happy. Until it occurs to me that now she's making Peter this happy. I'd always thought he and I were so good together. He was stable and reliable and driven. He had a 5-year plan, and not in a boring way. We were going to go see the cherry blossoms in Japan together, visit Dubai, see the Eiffel Tower. But we were also going to put money into retirement and have monthly dinners with his family. In short, Peter was the exact opposite of my dad, who was occasionally a doting father, but rarely a present one. It had taken a lot of therapy for me to stop gravitating toward emotionally unavailable men, the kind who'd get a matching tattoo with you 1 week and be dating your upstairs neighbor the next. I'd been so relieved when I finally fell in love with someone who actually wanted to love me back. A relationship guy who craved the bond his parents had,
who liked routine and texted back in a reasonable amount of time and shared his calendar with me. Maybe if we'd never moved back here, we'd still be together. Then again, maybe in 5 years he still would have left me for Petra. Maybe they're every bit as destined as he's convinced. I'm nauseated by the thought that maybe she belongs there, in that home I'd thought was mine, while I belong nowhere. Ashley points to the 2 1/2 pairs of Crocs. Yes, that's 5 individual Crocs, halfway in the closet. "Excuse me," she says. "How many Crocs does this man have?" "Well," I say, "at least those and the ones I assume are on his feet at this very moment." She stares at the clogs. "Service industry, nurse, or run-of-the-mill weirdo?" "Service industry," I confirm. Then, with a tickle of affection, "but also a weirdo. Which reminds me, we're supposed to try the Pinot tonight." "How did that remind you of Pinot?" she says. But as I turn to leave, I forget she asked. My stomach flips at the sight of the wall behind Miles's headboard. I've never noticed it before because I've only been in here one other time. Dozens of Polaroids are tacked in tidy columns. Tidier, I suspect, than Miles would have been. Likely, they're a holdover from his Petra era. Which makes sense, given that they very clearly tell the story of their relationship. 3 years worth of birthday cakes, 3 years worth of tiny tinsel Christmas trees, 3 years worth of stand-up paddle boarding, cliff jumping, sipping wine in front of a sunset, riding a share moped in front of what I assume to be the Mediterranean Sea. 3 years grinning into each other's mouths with their hands in each other's hair. They look so happy. It feels intrusive to see them like this, let alone to let my coworker gawk at the evidence of his failed relationship. "We should go," I say, quickly steering Ashley back into the hallway and closing the door behind us. Would he take her back? I find myself wondering, before seamlessly transitioning into, would I take Peter back? "Definitely not," I say aloud. "What?" Ashley says. "Nothing," I say. "Let's go get wine." Ashley follows me back to the front door, her head on a swivel. "Do you see ghosts or something?" "Or something," I say. "Well, Vince," she says, "you may not be FBI, but you're definitely more interesting than all that tweed lets on." "My last name is Vincent," I tell her. "See?" she says. "A whole syllable I knew nothing about. You're full of surprises." "I hate surprises," I tell her. Cherry Hill, like most local wineries, is on a peninsula that juts into the vast expanse of Lake Michigan's northernmost curve. The vineyards sprawl across gently rolling hills on either side of the long gravel road that brings us to the winery itself, all sleek glass, balsa wood, and corrugated metal. The parking lot is jammed, the gardens that encircle it bursting with colorful blooms, all tinted pinkish by the setting sun. Out beyond the flowers and hedges, whitewashed tables dot a grassy stretch, customers milling from the bocce court on one end to a duck pond at the other, delicately stemmed glasses in hand. Globe lights hang over the seating area, just waiting for the falling night to give them the cue to light up. "This place is gorgeous," I say, climbing out of Ashley's beat-up hatchback. It's cooled down, and I'm regretting not grabbing a jacket. She looks at me sidelong. "Haven't you been here?" I guess my blatant awe gave me away. Peter wasn't a wine guy. "Peter," she says, "that's your ex, right?" I manage a mm-hmm. Ashley swings her oversized bag onto her shoulder and tugs the hem of her miniskirt toward the tops of her suede, knee-high boots as she starts toward the front doors. "What about your friends? None of them wine guys either?" What I don't say is, we had all the same friends. What I don't say is, technically, this means I had no friends. Even after all those Frank Herbert novels I read just so I'd have something to bond with Scott over. "Guess not," I say. "What about you?
You've been here before, right?
Only twice, she says.
Duke wasn't a wine guy either.
And Duke is?
I pull the door open.
A large horse, she says.
What do you think, Daphne? He's my ex-husband.
I suppose I could have guessed that, I admit, and follow her inside.
A smell like burning cedar wafts toward us as we enter the dimly lit room. A sleek, modern bar runs along the left wall, the wall behind it entirely smoked glass, massive wine casks stacked behind it and softly glowing in golden light. The other three walls are likewise glass, but these look out over the vineyards, a narrow wooden counter mounted along them so people can watch the sunset while they sip. High tops are arranged in the middle of the room, and in the windowed wall opposite the bar, a huge slate fireplace reaches toward the vaulted ceiling, flames crackling and leaping within it. Ashley grabs my arm.
Come on, looks like those people are leaving.
She steers me to the far corner of the bar, which takes some maneuvering because, despite the temperate weather, the inside of this place is even busier than the lawn. She slides between two middle-aged men in golf shirts to claim one of the newly vacated stools, slamming her purse onto the other one and waving me over. She doesn't move her bag until I'm practically sitting on it. Underneath the hum of conversation, sexy music plays, a low, raspy voice that perfectly blends with the clatter of forks and delicate clink of glass. There are two people working the bar, but then a door swings open to the room hidden by the wall of casks, and Miles ducks through, carrying a wooden tray lined with glasses. It's hypnotic, the intricate dance between him and the other bartenders, or sommeliers, or whatever they are. They communicate in quick phrases and subtle touches, moving aside so he can replenish their supply. One bartender swaps places with him, and after a quick exchange, she nods and disappears through the same door Miles just emerged from. Despite his somewhat threadbare and hole-ridden t-shirt and work pants, he looks completely at home here, the warm glow behind the bar casting him in more of an artisanal light than a burned-out one. He leans across the counter to hear what a pretty redhead is saying, then laughs and grabs an open white wine from an ice bucket, twirling it a little as he pours her another glass.
See?
Ashley says, leaning in to be heard.
Hot drug dealer!
My gaze judders over to her, follows hers straight back to the far side of the bar.
Miles deals drugs?
I cry. His gaze snaps sideways at the sound of his name. He lifts his chin in greeting, a smile pulling at one side of his mouth.
Wait, you know him? Ashley asks.
He drops the bottle back into the ice bucket and crosses toward us.
Order the Pinot, I quickly tell Ashley. I'm really confused right now, Daphne. Have you been here or...
Miles slides his forearms across the glossy wooden bar.
Well, 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 he says, just loud enough to be heard over the room's ambient noise. If it isn't my adoring girlfriend.
7.
Girlfriend?
Ashley kicks me underneath the bar. I yelp and scoot away from her.
It's a joke. This is my roommate, Miles. Miles Ashley.
He sticks his hand out to shake hers.
Nice to meet you.
Charmed,
she says, suddenly a Gilded Age heiress.
What can I get you?
He asks. Ashley props her chin in her hand and leans forward to be heard.
What do you recommend?
He drags a paper menu out of a nearby cup and pushes it toward us.
Kitchen's out of a bunch of stuff, but we still have these.
He marks 3 of the 6 small plate options, then flips the menu and circles the wine flights, drawing scrappy little stars beside the one he recommends. He looks to me for approval. I look to Ashley. She nods and half shouts,
"Whatever Miles says!"
I'll be right back,
he promises, disappearing with the marked menu, stopping to murmur something to a bartender with curtain bangs before slipping through the door. Ashley swivels toward me.
So what's this hilarious joke about you being his girlfriend?
What's this about my roommate being a drug dealer? She waves a hand. That's just what I call him in my mind, because of his aesthetic.
His selling prescription bottles under the bleachers aesthetic?
More like 8 plants and grow light in his apartment, but that was before I unknowingly wandered into his bedroom 30 minutes ago. Now I have to revise his whole image in my brain castle.
Do you mean memory palace? I ask.
My turn to ask the questions.
Her eyes dance devilishly. I haven't seen this mischievous side of Ashley before. It's intimidating, feeling like I can't escape her curiosity, but it also reminds me a little bit of Sadie, which sends a pang through my stomach.
Tell me about this joke where you're hot Miles' girlfriend. Hello, ladies, the curtain-fringed bartender says, making us both jump. Hi, Ashley and I cheep in unison. Miles will be right back with your flight, but can I get you anything in the meantime?
She flips 2 water glasses onto the bar and fills them from a pitcher. We shake our heads.
Well, I'm Katya, if you need anything. Just shout.
She pats the bar and saunters off.
So, Ashley prods. The joke?
It was just about this picture. She arches a brow, waiting. I give in, pull my phone out, and tap to the picture of Miles and me, avocados smeared on my face, our mouths suspiciously close. It's more lascivious than I remembered. My stomach flutters uncomfortably. Ashley stares at it, a divot forming in her chin.
What, because you look so much like a couple in this? That's the whole joke?
I grimace, debating how much more to divulge. This is my problem. I don't know how to talk along the surface of things, but I also don't want to unearth the ugly stuff over and over again for people who are just passing through my life. It's depleting. Like every time I dole out a kernel of my history to someone who's not going to become a fixture in my life, a piece of me gets carried away, somewhere I can never get it back. You can't untell someone your secrets. You can't unsay those delicate truths once you learn you can't trust the person you handed them to. Ashley sets my phone aside.
Look, if you don't want to be friends, I'm not going to make you. We've worked together for over a year, and I've managed to learn startlingly little about you in that time, and I haven't pressed because I can tell when someone's a closed book.
I'm not a closed book, I protest.
But what I can't figure out, she says, is why ask me to hang out now? If this is just some Good Samaritan shtick, I would have rather stayed home than go on a pity outing.
It's not a pity outing, I say. At least not on my end. And I'm sorry I didn't make more of an effort to get to know you up front. It wasn't you. She gives me a pointed look.
Okay, maybe it was a little bit you, I admit.
She lets out a guffaw of genuine laughter that makes me crack a smile.
What, you think I'm scary?
Well, yes, I say, but in a good way. It's more that you're always late.
Another guffaw. God, you're not from Michigan, are you?
No, why? I say.
This honesty thing, she says. It's refreshing. So you didn't want to be friends with me because I'm always late to work.
And you didn't want to be friends with me because of the gigantic stick up my ass? I guess.
She chortles. No, it actually wasn't that. It was more that you were so happily coupled. The divorce is still too fresh for me to be around someone who's got cartoon hearts in their eyes and baby birds carrying a long lace veil behind them.
I didn't tell anyone at work about the breakup, per se. But when you have 3 weeks scheduled off work for a honeymoon, then unceremoniously cancel the request, people talk.
Well, even before my breakup, I tell her, I didn't have either of those things. Because of the stick? She jokes.
My own smile widens. Because baby birds are never on time. And it may seem trite, but when people are always late, I don't expect them to be reliable, and I definitely don't assume they're interested in being close with me.
She nods thoughtfully. Fair. But for what it's worth, I'm always late because I have a kid. So I'd like to think my friends can rely on me, but if it comes down to it, yeah, I choose Mulder every time.
If I'm a closed book, bound in chains and kept under a padlock, Ashley Rahimi might have said the one thing that could function as the key.
Also fair, I say. So, she says, have I earned the origin story of this joke?
There's something I haven't told everyone at the library, I say, buying myself time. About my breakup. Something humiliating. Her jaw drops.
You cheated with Miles.
What? God, no! I look around for eavesdroppers. If I'm going to utter this aloud one more time, I'd like it to stay in this room. How do I know this story won't race through the stacks at work like wildfire? She has the grace to not look offended. Instead, she purses her lips, considering.
Let me ask you this. Have I ever told you anything about Landon?
Other than that you two have a betting pool about what a freak I am?
Let's just say, she replies, when you get him to pause his My Bloody Valentine album, you'll find how easy it would be to make a full The Crown-style television series about his family, and yet you know nothing. I'm good with secrets.
You could be completely making this up, I point out.
Sure, she says, but I'm not. I'm a recent divorcee who spends most of her time with an 11-year-old. I'm not out here telling people secrets. I just enjoy hearing about drama. Sue me!
If you divulge what I'm about to tell you, I say, I might.
I've got it,
she cries, slapping both hands down on the bar. She swings her huge purse atop it and digs for her phone.
I currently have a horrible rash on my back. I'll send you a picture.
Please don't, I say.
It can be your collateral, she says.
What if, and stay with me here, you just, like, tell me something about yourself, I say. She narrows her gaze. Kind of an old-fashioned, actually getting to know each other approach. Precisely, I say.
What do you want to know?
Whatever you want to tell me, I say.
Well,
she sighs, looking up at the exposed beams across the ceiling as she thinks.
My kid was conceived in a parked car behind a YMCA. Does that do the trick?
A snort of laughter escapes me.
Oh!
She scoots forward, more animated now than I've yet seen her.
In sixth grade, the tissue I'd stuffed in my bra fell out of my shirt while I was at the whiteboard.
Oh my God, I say. So you're Dante. You went all the way to the ninth circle of the inferno.
What else?
Her eyes tip toward the ceiling again.
Oh!
When I first had Mulder, I had no idea what to do with him 90% of the time while Duke was at work, so I'd bring him to the library, to this mom's group, and I'd find the calmest parent in the bunch and ask if they could watch him while I went to the bathroom. Then I'd go lock myself inside, set a timer, and sob as hard as I could for 5 minutes.
Ashley! That's heartbreaking, I cry,
but she's laughing now, too.
It was terrible, she agrees. Every day I'd wake up and have like 1 second of peace. Then I'd remember, oh shit, I'm someone's mom. I was a wreck for like 6 months. But it did convince me to go back to school to become a librarian, and Mulder's pretty much my best friend, so all worth it.
My heart keens at the thought of my own mother. How even with the long hours she pulled at work, she made time to hand-sew Halloween costumes and chaperone field trips and stumble her way through helping me with algebra. She worked so hard to give me the best life she could, and I don't take any of it for granted. I just always thought our family of two would grow, and someday I'd have a house full of little voices, deep laughter, endless love. I thought the best mom ever would graduate to the world's best grandma, and I'd give someone new the love she gave me, but with a different kind of life, a full house where they didn't spend most nights alone waiting for their overworked mom to get home or a mostly absent father to deign to stop by.
What do you think?
Ashley bats her eyelashes. Have I earned some intel? I hold up a finger while I take a long sip of water.
Ooh, she needs to hydrate, she says. Must be juicy.
I set the glass down. I'm going to say this fast, and I'd prefer not to dwell on it too long.
Got it, she says.
Peter dumped me for his childhood best friend who happened to be Miles' girlfriend, and that's how we ended up living together. I say, all in one breath. Her jaw drops. I take another sip. And then I accidentally told Peter that Miles and I are dating now, so we took that picture to make the lie more convincing. Ashley's mouth forms a perfect circle. You're kidding. I hide my face behind my hands. I'm not.
I love it, she cries.
Volume, I'm realizing, is Ashley's primary indicator of emotion. That and the surprising bark laugh that occasionally jumps out of her before she's even cracked a smile.
What do we love?
I open my eyes to find Miles arranging wine glasses in front of us.
Your fake relationship, Ashley says.
Well, I don't, I say. Now there's no good way to get out of it. I mean, when we break up, Peter will get to feel smug and superior about that.
That's no problem,
Miles says, pouring a taste of white wine for each of us.
All we have to do is get married and then stay together until they split up. And if they have kids, just have one more than them. If they get a dog, we get a cuter dog. If they buy a new house, we get a mansion.
A perfect plan, I say. Why didn't I think of it? He pushes the wine glasses toward us.
Pinot Blanc. It's crisp and citrusy with a little bit of pear, and it goes well with poultry and seafood. I'm kidding about the marriage, by the way.
You don't say, I reply, taking a sip.
What do you think?
He leans forward, eager, focused. I let the taste roll across my tongue before swallowing it. It tastes like springtime. He smiles.
Exactly.
I think there's something wrong with mine, Ashley says. It tastes like wine.
Here.
Miles pours more.
Try again.
Ashley sips, then smacks her lips.
Oh, yeah. Big spring vibe.
Katya, with the curtain fringe, calls for Miles then. He glances over his shoulder. A middle-aged guy with slicked back hair, eyes disappearing into his face, is drunkenly leaning across the bar, demanding something of the bartenders. Miles pushes off the bar.
I'll be right back.
He beelines toward the drunk guy, a calm and polite smile fixed to his face, though something about his eyes has flattened out, changed, like he's peering out from heavily tinted windows. Ashley angles toward me.
Do you think if I keep being ignorant, he'll keep pouring more, or was that a one-time thing?
I watch him exchange a few words with the man. Miles nods, then bends his head toward Katya's, the two of them quietly conferring, her hands braced lightly against his shoulders as she pushes up onto her tiptoes to reach his ear. They both glance our way at the same time, and I spin back to Ashley, downing my drink.
I think you can just ask for more, I say, and he'll probably give it to you. I feel like a celeb, she says. I've never had this kind of in before.
Well, if having my heart shattered in the single most humiliating way imaginable can be of service to someone, I'll take it.
I'm sorry, sweetie, Ashley says, swirling her glass. But if Peter was going to break your heart now, he would have done it eventually.
So what, I say. Peter and Petra are soulmates and it was going to happen sooner or later?
Soulmates?
She laughs. No. I'm saying your ex is the little boy looking over someone else's shoulder trying to figure out if the kid next to him has a better lunch. Only the lunchbox is shut, so even though he knows what his parents packed for him is pretty good, he'd still trade it just to open up that rusty little Batman lunchbox.
What is this metaphor, Ashley? I say.
It makes perfect sense, she says. He's a lunch swapper, and whether it was the rusty metal Batman lunchbox or a Cars 2 zip-up one that's filled with mold, at some point he was going to trade in the sack lunch.
Just to be clear, I'm the sack lunch here, I say.
It ain't about the bag, babe, she says. It's what's inside.
So I'm a paper sack with a heart of gold.
You could be a three-course balanced meal with a cute little hostess dessert and it wouldn't matter. He knows you, and the lunch he doesn't know is going to catch his eye. I'm sorry, I just realized I'm really hungry, so that probably explains some of the...
Oh, thank God!
Miles is back, unloading our order in front of us. A board with three local cheeses, a variety of pickled vegetables, and some Waning Bay preserves, along with a basket of bread from a bakery in town.
So, he says, a bit of a snag.
What, you ran out of grapes? I say.
His eyes flick down as he lifts the next bottle from beneath the bar.
Katya, my coworker.
He clears his throat as he pours our next taste.
She heard from Petra about my new girlfriend.
Oh no, I say. He grimaces.
I am really sorry, Daphne.
She just asked if it was me, didn't she? I say. If I'm the new girlfriend. He nods, the tea light sprinkling the bar, catching the flush creeping up his neck. And you said yes, I say. The flush deepens.
I don't know what came over me.
Ashley tips her head back and laughs. The man to her left turns at the sound and gives her a flirtatious body scan, which she, in her delight, entirely misses.
I love this so much!
She claps to emphasize each word.
I'm never lying again, I say.
Except if Katya walks up to you and says, hey, you're sleeping with Miles, right?
He jokes.
Because if you tell the truth, this will all be very embarrassing.
You told her we're sleeping together? I say.
Yeah, she said, is that your girlfriend? And I was like, we have sex and we're in love. Someday, when we have a baby, we're going to name her Sue Ellen after my mom. No, Daphne, I didn't tell her we're sleeping together. Petra told her I'm living with my new girlfriend. I'm just guessing Katya might do some high-level deduction here. But if you want me to go ask whether she thinks we're having sex, I can.
How soon until everyone in Waning Bay hears this lie? I groan.
I'm sure the paparazzi are gathering as we speak, he replies. This is the 2020 Chardonnay, by the way. People think they hate Chardonnay because they've mostly had shitty Chardonnay. It's a misunderstood wine.
Aw, Ashley coos, clutching her heart. Misunderstood little wine.
Don't feel too bad for it, I mumble. Sounds like it gets laid a lot. Miles gives me a teasingly admonishing look and goes on.
Ours is pretty restrained.
Okay, I take my last comment back, I say.
See, Daphne,
he says, meeting my heckling with over-the-top sobriety.
The Chardonnay grapes themselves are pretty neutral. That's why they can take on too much oak for a lot of wine drinkers' tastes. But ours has a nice peach nose and this pinch of lemon zest and a faint, warm oakiness, but not so much that the wine's overpowered.
It really is a lovely nose, Ashley says.
Thanks, I think so too.
Miles angles himself back to me, clearly waiting for me to try it. I make a big show of swirling it around and studying it from various angles, then, very, very slowly, lift it to my lips and take one tiny sip. Still, that one sip makes the inside of my mouth feel sunlit, like I've just tasted a day on the Michigan coast. Wow, I say. Miles straightens, grinning.
It's good.
It's good, I answer. A bright flash pops to our left, and I glance over at Ashley, little colorful circles still dancing through my vision. Aw, she says, looking down at her phone.
Your first couple's candid.
The man behind her taps her shoulder.
If you want one of all three of you,
he shouts over the music, which has gotten louder as full night has fallen,
I'd be happy to take it.
That's okay,
I try to shout back, but Ashley is nodding enthusiastically.
I'm vetting my friend's new boyfriend, she tells him. Aren't they cute?
If anything, I say to Miles, we're still vetting her. He looks over, smile deepening.
I say we keep her.
Who's going to feed and walk her? I say.
I will, he insists. Every day, I promise.
Ashley drags her stool around mine and pops back onto it, leaning in against my side as her suitor lines up her phone for the shot. Miles slides one elbow further over the bar, leaning in on my other side, his chin resting on my shoulder.
Everyone say wine,
the man says with a wink. Under her breath, Ashley mumbles,
I can look past that.
8. In the corner, Ashley and Greg Craig, can't be sure which one he introduced himself as, are fully making out. They went over there to exchange numbers roughly 6 minutes ago. Everyone else in that corner of the tasting room has since fled. In Ashley and Greg Craig's defense, that might have more to do with the fact that it's 9:57 and Cherry Hill closes at 10. Sure, it's a Friday night, but this is a winery in northern Michigan, not a rave in Ibiza, and all the customers probably need to be up bright and early for yoga, boating, or doing yoga on a boat.
She okay to drive?
I turn to find Miles slipping through a portion of the bar that lifts up, with his wallet, phone, and an apron clutched in one hand.
Oh, she's not drunk, I assure him. She didn't have a sip of the last two pours. She's just horny.
He nods somberly.
Being single in the woods is rough.
At that moment, Ashley extricates her tongue from Greg Craig's mouth and flounces our way.
So!
With a furtive glance over her shoulder, she drops her voice. What are the odds you can ride home with Miles? I look to him. He flips his keys.
Fine with me.
Thank God.
Ashley gives me a brief, firm, yet vanilla-scented hug.
Don't make this weird at work, okay?
What, the fact that I've now seen someone lick your tonsils? I say.
It was bound to happen eventually. Get home safe, lovebirds.
She's already on her way back to Greg Craig. He slips a hand through hers and waves as she steers him outside.
So,
Miles says,
Craig's friend wasn't up to your standards?
I'm embarrassed to realize Miles witnessed my painful attempt at conversation with Craig's wingman, a guy in a V-neck so deep I caught a flash of belly button.
I wasn't up to his standards, I say. He got a pretty urgent work-related text and excused himself. Then I went to the bathroom, and when I passed him, he was playing solitaire on his phone at the far side of the bar.
What the fuck?
Miles says. In his defense, I say, I'm absolutely horrible at small talk with new people.
I don't believe you at all, he says.
Within 3 minutes, I say, I caught myself listing my food sensitivities. I think it's like a self-sabotaging, self-protective thing where I try to bore new people away. Miles looks horrified.
You should have told me you had food sensitivities before I ordered for you.
It's not like EpiPen serious. I say, following him to the door.
Still, he says, and if I'd known you needed help with the solitaire king of northern Michigan, I could have rustled up a pack of cards from the break room. You'd have been unstoppable.
I'm not sure I'm in the mood to be unstoppable anyway.
He holds the door open for me.
What about milkshakes?
What about them? I say.
Are you in the mood for one?
He says.
Because I've been thinking about Big Louise all night.
Who's Big Louise? I say, stepping out into the still night. And does she know how much you think about her?
Big Louise Drive-In?
The string lights ringing the gravel lot softly illuminate his look of surprise.
You've never been to Big Louise?
No, I say. He stops short, looking at me with outrage.